So I did not grow up in snow and ice like this. Most of you know I grew up in mostly sunny Southern California. And when I was in college, I, along with Kirsten, volunteered with our youth group at our church. And one of the things that our youth group began to do during those years was joined with a ministry that was based down in San Diego that every Saturday would go over the border into Mexico and to an area of the Tijuana dump, the landfill, where there were people living. And they would bring food, they'd bring clothing, they'd bring makeshift showers and other needs for health care. And they would bring games for the children and books for the fledgling school that was actually taking place in the dump. And so for my first adventure, I didn't exactly know what to expect, but I went down with our group and we met up with the folks in San Diego and we got the rundown of what we were going to be doing. We crossed the border and we entered the dump, and I was amazed at what I saw, because what I saw was a community. It was a neighborhood. And we arrived and the children came running out and we set up some carnival games for them and we began setting out the food, and the people were lined up with smiles on their faces waiting to get some provisions that were desperately needed. And there was another station where there were clothes and some of the other items that were brought. And there was also a health aid station set up, including the showers, so that people could get these basic necessities of life that were not available to them where they were living. And as the morning stretched into the afternoon and I spent some time playing games with the kids and spent a little time passing out food, and then I just started walking around the neighborhood and watching the people. And there was a very old woman who saw me and came up to me and sort of tugged on my arm. And she was smiling, and she sort of motioned to me to follow her. And so I followed her down the road where she was headed, and then she turned into what looked like, from the outside, a big heap of trash, of garbage. But as she made her way towards that heap and then entered it, I realized that she was inviting me into her home. And so I ducked my head and entered into this dwelling that was somehow put together with boxes and magazines and old catalogs and any sort of piece of junk that she could find that could stick and mold together with some of the others to make this makeshift dwelling. And I was astonished that she was living in this kind of situation, but that she also had the wherewithal and the fortuitiveness and the creativity to be able to put together some kind of structure like this to shelter her. And I looked around this very small dwelling, and I noticed sort of propped up against one of the makeshift walls was a crucifix. And I noticed a few other things that I recognized must have been keepsakes of hers that she had very intentionally set out along the wall. And she was motioning to some of them and speaking in Spanish, and my Spanish is broken at best. So I didn't really exactly understand what she was describing, but what I sensed was that these were very meaningful artifacts to her. And as we continued to move our way around this very small dwelling, I noticed that there really wasn't a window. The only way to have any sort of illumination in there was through this tiny doorway into the space. And so at one point, I tried to cobble together a few of the Spanish words I knew to ask her. I said, ¿Dónde está to lose? Where is your lighting? Because I'm wondering at night, how does she survive? How does she make it through those nights? It is down just south of the California border, but it does get chilly down there at night too. And she wasn't quite tracking with me, and so I tried to think of a few other words, and I said, ¿Cómo illuminar su casa? How do you light your house? And she looked at me, and she had this simple, humble smile on her face. And she didn't say a word, but she just went like this. With her hand on her chest, tapping it very gently. And I realized what she was trying to say to me. It's within. My light is in here. The prophet Isaiah was speaking in his time to a people who were looking for light. The people of Israel were in exile in Assyria, and they were grasping for any remnant of hope, for any sign of promise. And woven through Isaiah's prophecies are these poems that scholars over the centuries have come to entitle the poems of the suffering servant. Because Isaiah returns to this theme multiple times in this section of his prophecy. And he speaks of this suffering servant. Some of the passages that are later on in Isaiah are very familiar to us in the Christian tradition because they're usually read around Easter time, where we hear the words of how this suffering servant was wounded for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. And by his wounds we are healed. Well, this passage of Isaiah 42 is the first of the suffering servant poems. And for those of us in our tradition, in the Christian tradition, when we hear these passages, we tend to take them and appropriate the language of them and the imagery of them to one person. We hear suffering servant, and we put an equal sign, and after the equal sign, we put Jesus. That what Isaiah was talking about centuries before even his arrival on this earth was that Isaiah was foretelling the coming of the suffering servant, the Messiah, the Christ, the one who would come and bring justice and peace, the one who is the light of the world. But what did it mean for the people in Isaiah's time? Was the word Isaiah had to give to these people in exile is wait about 7 centuries. And then this person's going to come and everything's going to be right. No, prophecy is not only foretelling, it's also forthtelling. It's meant to give a word of hope to people in the here and now. And so what could it have meant to the people in that era? Isaiah's original audience, God's children in Israel. Well, if we look at the context of Isaiah's writings and the context of life in which they were living, an exilic period, the sense that scholars have and that tradition is carried forward is that Isaiah, when he's using singular language, is not necessarily talking about a singular person, but is using that image as a way to more immediately and forcefully communicate to God's people in that time. And if that's the case, then the imagery isn't necessarily just talking about one person who will rise up out of the people of Israel at that time, but rather that it's the people of Israel themselves who are the suffering servant. It's the community of God who are the embodiments of this service. And if that's the case, then it's God's people who are the ones who are servants, who are upheld, chosen, delightful to God, bearers of spirit, bringers of mercy and compassion and justice and passion. Later in our passage, Isaiah describes the God who gives breath and spirit not just to Israel and not just to the quote-unquote people of God, but to all people. Could this be that Isaiah in his time is giving us a word in our time? That as God's children in his age, we're called to be that servant, that light to all nations, that bringer of justice and compassion. That message carries forward to today. And that as we hear these words in our tradition, maybe they're not only talking about the one who came in the name of the Lord and the one who embodied that light to the nations, but that it is also a calling to each of us to say we are the light to the nations. We are the ones who've been given this calling. We are the bearers of that light. And yet instead, throughout most all of our tradition's history, we've taken words like this and put them all on Jesus, which means we've also put all the responsibility onto Jesus. And so we say, Jesus is the light of the world. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Christ. Jesus is the light that shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it or understood it. As if Jesus came to show us that only he can do everything, and conversely, we can do nothing. We've even used passages from our own scriptures, drawn out of context, to emphasize this belief. In John's gospel, where we hear the words from John the Baptist talking about Jesus, that he must increase, I must decrease. And I grow up hearing phrases like that with the message being that by the end of my life, Jesus must be everything because I am nothing. Or the words of Paul in his letter to the Colossians, where he says, there is only Christ, he is everything. Part of a sentence, part of a paragraph, part of a larger thought. But taken out of that context, again, we hear this message of, if Christ is everything, then surely I must be nothing. Why then would Jesus, in his words that we have recorded in these Gospels, say not only that he is the light of the world, but that in his most famous collection of sayings, the Sermon on the Mount, he would say, you are the light of the world. We are the light of the world. I wonder, perhaps, it's because Jesus came to us not to be everything, but rather to perfectly embody that love that is everything, and to shine the light of that love into our world and into our lives to awaken us and even to remind us that that same spark of light is within each of us. Could it be that Jesus shows us fully and completely who he is and who God is, so that we can be reminded of who we are? Could it be that Jesus embodied that perfect love to awaken us to the reality that we are made of perfect love? And that we are made to embody that perfect love as well. Could it be that Jesus is the light of the world in order to reawaken us to the truth and to empower us in the fact that we are the light of the world? that that is the core of our identity, the center of our being. And that what we are made for is to live that light, to bear that light, to share that light. On the cover of your bulletin, there's a quote from Brené Brown. And as I think about how do we bear this light, how do we be this light, I found these words very provocative and very inspiring. Only when we are brave enough to explore the darkness will we discover the infinite power of our light. If you're like me, when you hear a word like this, the thought that comes to my mind is some of the words that we read earlier in Isaiah's prophecy. But I'm a bruised reed. I'm a dimly burning wick. There seems to be more within me that's darkness, more that I see around me that's darkness than light. I wonder if this calling from Isaiah, this invitation from God, is to engage, explore, and even embrace those parts of us and those parts of our world that are darkness. The places where we feel bruised. The places where that light that we supposedly bear is a smoldering wick. I wonder if the calling is to explore that darkness, because it's through that exploration and that embracing that we discover more deeply and more fully and more powerfully the light. Thomas Merton once said that there's no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun. And I think he's right. There is no way of telling people, just as I'm trying to tell you, and I'm trying to tell me. And maybe that's because it's something that's less to be told and more to be enacted. Maybe that's why the calling is to be the light. Like that dear older woman I met in Tijuana, who didn't have to say a word, but by the countenance on her face and by her actions of inviting me into her home and showing hospitality and sharing part of her story with me, and even by wordlessly pointing to the source of her light, how might we do the same in our own unique and idiosyncratic and wonderful way? Amen.